It wouldn't be unreasonable to assume that the hate that germinated and grew and flourished and festered with the Nazis and their supporters also died with them. That hate took the lives of 6 million Jews, a genocide the world should never forget. So having said that, it's almost unbelievable that hatred in the form of anti-Semitism is again in evidence and on the rise on a global scale. Much of this hate is transmitted via the internet. Many write this stuff off as the rantings of lunatics, and that may be so, but the audience is vast, and that simply emboldens them to continue spewing their vile and vitriolic messages. Journalist and commentator Richard Cook has been looking at the new rise of an old hate, and he joins us via Skype from New Zealand. Richard, welcome to Counterpoint.
Pleasure, Amanda.
Well, if there is a rise, and I'm not disputing that, it's a pretty ugly phenomenon, isn't it? Can you tell me, what would you put that down to? What's happened that's made this ugliness rear its head again?
Look, I think that there's a number of different kind of social issues which are feeding into some very old forms of hatred. Part of it is just the rise of the internet. So, you know, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which were once not that easy to encounter, you know, you would see them very occasionally in pamphlets or newsletters, are now quite common on the internet. You know, it's not difficult for people who hold those views to broadcast them very widely, and they're doing that quite successfully.
Mm. Apparently you met with Matt Bye, a commentator in the United States, over a couple of drinks. I assume they were iced coffees, of course.
And naturally.
Naturally. And he shared with you some information about the rise of anti-Semitic tweets. Do you have those figures in front of you?
I don't, but I know that the figure which has really, you know, headlined this study that the Anti-Defamation League did in the United States is that over the course of the US election campaign, anti-Semitic tweets directed at journalists were viewed over a billion times. I mean, viewed there can mean that they were just, you know, that there were impressions of them, but there was a very dedicated campaign by a small number of alt-right figures and white supremacists, which was capable of finding a very large audience quite successfully.
Yeah, well, that is a very large audience. And Ben Shapiro, I mean, I read the New York Times myself, and I've read a few of his articles, and he shares the view that he had nearly 7,500 pieces of anti-Semitic abuse after an article that he'd done. Now, that's just outrageous, isn't it? That means there's a whole lot of crazies out there who, using social media in the confidence that they won't get caught, just say whatever they like.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think that this is just done under anonymous conditions. It's done under some quite open trolling conditions, if you like. Milo Yiannopoulos, the former Breitbart commentator and kind of provocateur, recently had a party, for example, where dwarves or little people came out in yarmulkes with Ben Shapiro written across their shirts as a way of sort of mocking, you know, with quite an obvious anti-Semitic undertone.
Yeah, sure.
This person who you know, left the Breitbart Empire partly because of these issues.
So it's not just the confidence of anonymity. This is actually out there, open, full on, in your face.
I think that it's a combination. You know, this edge is always moving, and people are, you know, especially at a time when the tone of commentary has become very vicious, you know, this edge of what is acceptable to say publicly is constantly on the move. And, you know, I was just reading then a interview with someone who's been involved in white supremacism for many, many years. And he is saying, you know, the conversation which used to happen in the bathroom is now happening in the parlour. You know, it's quite noticeable that topics, comments, which would have been unacceptable only a few years ago are now part of the open discourse again.
Mm. I find this area quite difficult because I am a great supporter, I think I am anyway, I hope I am, of free speech, but it does, of course, have its limitations. And so let's put them aside. What it reveals, however, is how some people really think, and that's what's ugly. I mean, it is ugly that they say it, whatever they say that's offensive. But what's really ugly to me is that they actually think it.
I think that
Where do you think people get this position from in their head? We can talk later about the publication thereof, but how do they get it in their head that that's an acceptable human type of attitude to have?
I think that this is complicated, and I think that it is possible that, you know, the question of how deeply people hold these beliefs can be quite difficult to answer. I mean, if you look at the past, some people, you know, especially after the Second World War, who went on to become very well-known anti-Semites, David Irving, the, you know, so-called revisionist historian, and George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of what was called the American Nazi Party. Now, both of those people had people close to them. David Irving's brother, for example, said that he deep down thinks that David Irving doesn't really believe this stuff and just does it for attention. I mean, it's kind of how much, you know, how deeply internally held these views are is in some ways kind of irrelevant. And what you're seeing now, you know, in some ways both of those figures are prototype trolls. You know, they're behaving in a very provocative way to get a lot of attention. They're often operating in bad faith. And that is something we're seeing a huge deal of coming from the internet, you know, coming from people who feel a lack of investiture in wider society. And they want to violate other people's taboos. This is one of the few forms of power available to them. And there are few taboos which are more offensive than things like Holocaust denial.
Mm. So these people are sort of narcissistic attention getters.
Yeah, look, I think it's very complicated. I think that some people start off doing this for attention. They start off almost doing it as a kind of black humour, you know, a very provocative, very bad taste black humour. And as these incentives, especially the incentive of attention, flow towards them, it can start to kind of underwrite these views and they can start to hold them in a way which is seemingly much more genuine.
That's a hard question though, isn't it, for a position for people to be in, because when you realise they're doing it for attention, you're tempted to say, well, just ignore them. And I know from my own experience in politics that ignoring your critics makes them really mad.
Yes.
Because someone is being critical of you and nasty about you in order to have an impact on you, and if they don't see that they're having it, they sometimes give up. But that doesn't always work with anti-Semitism, does it? If you ignore it, some people think, oh, well, that was okay, I'll step it up a bit, and just keep going and it gets worse. So what do you think is the appropriate response, to turn the other cheek or smack them in the face?
We're in the process of finding out. And I think that right now we're going through a process where what we thought was kind of a liberal consensus that discriminating against people is wrong is starting to disappear. You know, it has to be re-argued from first principles. And I am not looking forward to that process.
We're talking with journalist and commentator Richard Cook by Skype from Dunedin in New Zealand about the unattractive rise of anti-Semitism. Now, Richard, can you help me? I'm not a technical genius, let's put it that way, not a technical genius. Let's talk about the echoes that you've mentioned that I think started off, which is a triple parentheses, triple brackets, at either end of some words, which you want not the people, the machines, if you like, that scour the internet for inappropriate commentary, therefore miss because of these parentheses. But now they've started, the anti-Semitic people have started to put them on to demonstrate that, you know, I am using anti-Semitic terminology, and you can see that, you can see I intended to do that because I've put these parentheses around the words. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. So you might have an individual's name, say a Jewish journalist in the United States, and when these people use that person's name on the internet, they will put a set of triple parentheses around their name. And this is a way of kind of, you know, tagging them, if you like, as a Jew or as someone associated with, you know, these people are trying to invoke anti-Semitic tropes, but do it in a way where it's a kind of in-group code. And this has become, you know, common enough that anti-discrimination organizations in the United States and elsewhere are identifying these as hate symbols.
Can you tell us about, I'm about to reveal how out of touch with the, what would you call it, current popular culture I am, if it is in fact popular culture. I'd never heard of PewDiePie, never.
Okay.
But PewDiePie must be worth a bit because they did a few things that occasioned them to lose YouTube and Disney advertising relationships worth millions of dollars. So PewDiePie must be worth quite a bit. But what's the story with that?
Yes, so, I mean, I think this is a story which demonstrates the complexity, if you like, of ascribing blame, of how accountability occurs in a new media culture that in some ways no one's really in control of anymore. So PewDiePie is a Swedish YouTuber. He's a guy who just plays, you know, video games and makes jokes and does little pranks. On YouTube, he's very, very popular. He has many millions of viewers, and he made a number of jokes which were described as anti-Semitic. Now, it seemed like the jokes were driven by this kind of, you know, taboo violation, if you like. He has come out subsequently and said, "I'm not an anti-Semite. I don't endorse racism in any way." But these jokes were enough for more mainstream media companies like Disney and YouTube to sever advertising relationships with him, very valuable ones.
Well, how is it that people get away with that, saying, well, they do something that's seen as being anti-Semitic and then say, oh, it wasn't me, or I didn't mean that, or I didn't know that?
Well, I'm not sure how the accountability flows in this situation. Does making an anti-Semitic joke make someone an anti-Semite? I think that's a difficult question to answer. It certainly gives them an anti-Semitic intent. And, you know, white supremacists have come out and said, it doesn't matter if he meant it. He is underwriting our worldview. He is helping us. So his intention is irrelevant. I think that's probably partly how these consequences should flow in situations like this. But because of this, you know, kind of trolling culture, which is a lot of it's based around irony and not taking anything seriously and, you know, being sort of antisocial. This is, I've heard it compared to, you know, boys throwing stones through windows. This is the kind of discourse version of that. It's sometimes these questions, how seriously do we take this? What did someone really mean? I don't think these things have clear answers anymore in the way that they used to.
And that, in fact, makes it harder, doesn't it? That's why this is a difficult area to handle. If it was simple, we could make a law and, you know, punish people who breach the law, but it isn't always that easy. Richard Cook, thanks for raising these issues. I hadn't heard of the neo-Nazi Sparky to whom you refer. But I'm now aware of that. I'm sorry we've got that kind of thing in Australia, but we have. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Amanda. Thank you.
That was journalist and commentator Richard Cook talking about the worrying rise of global anti-Semitism and making it clear that we in Australia are not immune from that.